Srimad Bhagavatam, first canto, chapter 8, prayers by Queen Kunti, text 26. Translation. My Lord, your lordship can easily be approached, but only by those who are materially exhausted. One who is on the path of material progress, trying to improve himself with respectable parentage, great opulence, high education, and bodily beauty, cannot approach you with sincere feeling. Purport. Being materially advanced means taking birth in an aristocratic family, possessing great wealth and education, and attractive personal beauty. All materialistic men and women are mad after possessing all these material opulences. And this is known as the advancement of material civilization. But the result is that by possessing all these material assets, one becomes artificially puffed up, intoxicated by such temporary possessions. Consequently, such materially puffed up persons are incapable of uttering the holy name of the Lord by addressing him feelingly. O Govinda, O Krishna. It is said in the Shastras that by once uttering the holy name of the Lord, the sinner gets rid of a quantity of sins that he is unable to commit. Such is the power of uttering the holy name of the Lord. There is not the least exaggeration in this statement. Actually, the Lord's holy name has such powerful potency. But there is a quality to such utterances also. It depends on the quality of feeling. A helpless man can feelingly utter the holy name of the Lord, whereas a man who utters the same holy name in great material satisfaction cannot be so sincere. A materially puffed up person may utter the holy name of the Lord occasionally, but he is incapable of uttering the name in quality. Therefore, the four principles of material advancement, namely, 1, high parentage, 2, good wealth, 3, high education, and 4, attractive beauty, are, so to speak, disqualifications for progress on the path of spiritual advancement. The material covering of the pure spirit soul is an external feature, as much as fever is an external feature of the unhealthy body. The general process is to decrease the degree of the fever and not to aggravate it by maltreatment. Sometimes it is seen that spiritually advanced persons become materially impoverished. This is no discouragement. On the other hand, such impoverishment is a good sign as much as the falling of temperature is a good sign. The principle of life should be to decrease the degree of material intoxication, which leads one to be more and more illusioned about the aim of life. Grossly illusioned persons are quite unfit for entrance into the kingdom of God. Om Gyana Chimanandasya Gyana Jana Shukaya Chakshun Manitani Tasmai Shri Gurave Jaya Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nithananda Sri Advaita Gadadhara Shivasani Gaura Bhakta Vrinda.
Hare Krishna 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 Hare Hare, Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare.
Last night we talked about the concept of progress and how in a sinister, hidden way it influences us. We actually think that things are moving forward, but actually the only thing moving forward is time. We get this artificial idea that things are developing around us and we are developing. In fact, we have this idea that we are maturing as we get older and becoming wiser. The adults can look at the teenagers, as the teenagers do their risky and wild things. And the adults have some satisfaction. They'll learn like we did. But what have the adults learned? What do they know? They're also doing risky, crazy things. In fact, no one has any concept anymore of what is a risky thing to do and what is a sane thing to do. As the standards of human society decline more and more, what is the result? You have to honestly face the fact that the result is simply more and more animalism. The thin covering that disguises human life as animal life, materialistic human life as animal life, that thin covering simply becomes more and more, it disintegrates more and more. So that's actually the so-called progress that you see. The thin veil becomes thinner and thinner. And people even say outright, oh, we're just animals. Let's just get into it. But there's really no difference, they say, between human beings and animals. So why don't we just honor our animal proclivities? And that way we'll be psychologically healthy. Why confuse your mind with so many restrictions, with so many prohibitions, inhibitions, religious guilt complexes, which are meant for the primitive persons? Just act on your impulses. Reminds me of the theory of Freud, who said that actually the main pleasure for everyone in life is sex indulgence. In that, he agrees with the Vedic conclusion about what goes on in material existence and what is the basis. So that's the main pleasure. But in order for human beings, he said, to live together in a society, they have to curb those instincts for unrestricted expression of lust. They can't just be like animals pouncing on everything in sight whenever the time of the year comes. Of course, at least animals are regulated by nature. So Freud, he theorized that human beings voluntarily accept austerity by accepting social conventions in terms of their mating behavior. And they do that in order to have a peaceful society, even though real happiness comes from just a human being pouncing on whatever is around. That would be the real state of bliss. But you can't have a society in that way. You can't have a peaceful, smooth functioning society like that. So therefore, for the sake of having an orderly human civilization, you sacrifice your happiness and don't pounce on everything in sight. So therefore, he claims that the human being has willfully restricted and constricted the self, willfully taken on this severe austerity just for the sake of social harmony. When actually, if the human being was really going to be happy, he'd just be an outright animal. But that can't be done. So that's why human beings are so hung up. That's why they're confused. Because they can't go for the true Ananda. They're deprived of that true Ananda for the sake of social harmony. The problem, of course, is that such persons, such theorists, don't know what true Ananda is. So they have to look to the material plane. They have to look to the material platform. And on the material platform, it's true. The highest pleasure is the scratching of the itch. So they say, well, what's restricting that scratching? That's the source of our problems. So naturally, you'll reason like that if you have no idea of the spiritual platform. But bhakti means not only to get an idea of the spiritual platform, but also to taste the spiritual platform. We are not theorists. We're not theoretical. Bhakti is the greatest philosophy. The Vedas contain every possible approach to knowledge and to life that a human being can come up with. It deals with all kinds of material theories and dispels them. It is the most comprehensive knowledge. So it's not that the Krishna Bhakta is locked in on some narrow religious theology. This is why it's so important for our practitioners to have a comprehensive understanding of the Shastra. So you truly see the incomparable scope of Bhagavad Dharma, its knowledge, its unparalleled inclusiveness, covering everything, dealing with everything, touching on every subject matter. So let's continue to talk about progress. Queen Kunti is mentioning that. She says, one who is on the path of material progress. So, what does it mean to be on that path? It means you believe that improving your material life will make you happy. And if a little bit of materialism makes you happy, then naturally you think more materialism will make me happy. Now, according to materialistic philosophers, you may try to restrict yourself due to hang-ups. Well, even though I know more materialism will make me happy, it's actually not a good thing, you know. It's kind of immoral. Of course, we know those complexities are disappearing quite quickly. I was discussing with our local philosopher here, Radha Prasad, and she was like, I was asking about parenting, from her experiences throughout New Zealand culture. So she said that there are two types of parents, she saw when growing up. One type is very strict on their children. And the other type has the idea, just be the best friend of your children. And just be there side by side as they go through their wildness. You're just their friend. Of course, the other type, very strict. Don't do this, don't do that. So I asked her, well, what's the end result of both types of parents? She said, it's all the same. The kids just do whatever they want anyway. Well, you have a strict parent. Or one of those kind of trendy, shall we say, North Shore type of parents. Whatever makes you happy. I'm just your friend. No one really knows what the right thing to do is. In any case, the end result is the same. The kids just do what they want. So, some people equate progress with just abandoning all restrictions. And then those who try to put restrictions in place feel discouraged because they don't see any effect from it. So they also then join the other camp. Well, just everyone should just, do what they're going to do because they're going to do what they're going to do anyway. You can imagine what the Society of Bhakti Yoga Practitioners would be like if we adopted that point of view. You all can just, whatever. It wouldn't be human life, what to speak of spiritual life. As Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita, there are the regulated principles of freedom. So these strictures that we follow, these rules and regulations, are not to shackle you and psychologically restrict you. They're actually to allow you to be free. So once you understand that, then you'll lose any of this materially conditioned notions you may have that, I know we're supposed to follow these rules, but it's kind of inconvenient. They kind of get in the way of the natural flow of things. By studying Srimad Bhagavatam, you'll get a thorough understanding of the regular principles of freedom. What is it you're trying to free? We are trying to free the pure spirit soul from its material confines. Is it like when you're sick, you go to the doctor and he gives you medicine and you view the medicine as confining you? No, an unintelligent person will think like that. But someone who knows understands that the medicine will make me healthy. It's contributing to my, relatively speaking, my freedom. Let us continue to talk about this notion of material progress. Remember last night, those of you who were here, we spoke about how it's an artificial conception. It's an hallucination. You have to think about it deeply and see through the eyes of the Shastra. Where is the actual progress? Look into the interior of the human being and try to see some progress. Don't be bewildered by the proliferation of technological gadgets. Don't be bewildered by the complexity of the entertainment systems. Look into the heart of the human being, and what you see is terrifying. So we spoke last night about how Srila Prabhupada, I found, gave a very fascinating insight into why we have this idea of progress in our consciousness. He says it's because Maya gets into your ear and broadcasts to you, this is progress, you're making progress. And you, oh yes, yes, yes. The idea is planted in your consciousness by the illusory energy. But it takes a lot of humility for us to accept that. No, Maya would never, no, I'm me. My life is under my control. I have to do what the boss says at work or the lecturer says at the uni. I have to do what, my partner says. So many birds have to do what they say, but no, I'm in control. Maya is not speaking to me. But just think, this idea of progress. The illusory energy's gotten in your ear and said, this is progress. This is the pinnacle of human civilization. Don't you know it? Once you start considering the whole concept as an implant, then you start to see more clearly. Now let's look at a typical situation. We spoke about it a few years ago at our Christmas festival. An example given by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. You're walking through the forest, enjoying, you think, the smells of the breezes laden with the aromas of the flowers, the touch of the breezes on your skin. If you're walking barefoot in the forest, it's a warm day, you feel the soft earth under your feet. You hear the birds chirping, the streams passing by. You see the beauty of the forest. But then, what happens? You hear a sound, a very frightening sound. You hear the growl of a tiger. Your whole day in the forest is just finished now in terms of your pleasure. From nowhere, this tiger has come. You just hear it, you don't see it. So immediately what do? You start to run. I've got to get away. And you can't see the tiger, but the tiger, you can hear it crashing through the forest after you. You're running, I've got to escape. There's a tiger, I hear the tiger. I don't see it, but I hear it. My life is in danger. And then what happens? You see a deep hole in front of you. It's an abandoned well. Oh, I'm saved. I'll just jump into this hole. Or rather, it's so deep, I'll climb down the edge of it. And the tiger won't be able to get me. There are two branches hanging over the edge of this abandoned well. So you grab one branch with each hand and you lower yourself into the well. Ah, when I get to the bottom, I'll be safe. But what's at the bottom of the well? Oh no, snakes. There's a whole bunch of snakes. Oh my goodness, and they're the poisonous type. Oh, what? If I go down, I'm finished. If I go up, the tiger is peering over the edge of the abandoned well. Oh no, what am I gonna do? You're holding on to those two branches, one branch in each hand. You've lowered yourself partially into the well in that way. How long can I hold on to these branches? I've got to make a decision to go up or down. Either way, it's disaster. Maybe I just stay here and maybe something will happen. I'll just keep holding on. Oh no, what do I see? There are two rats at the edge of the well. And each rat is nibbling on one of the branches. One rat is black, the other rat is white. In other words, I can't tread water. I can't even stay put and become frozen by the fear. I've got no choice. If I go up before the rats chew the branches that I'm holding on to, the tiger's there. If I let go of the branches and go down into the bottom of the well, the snakes are there. Oh, what to do? Oh. So what would you say? Well, this is just a hopeless situation. But is it really a hopeless situation? What do you think? The snakes are down below at the bottom of the well. Poisonous snakes just waiting. The tiger's on the top of the well. And you're holding on to the two branches. And the white rat and the black rat, each one is nibbling on a branch. What? Is it the end? Is there no way out? What do you think? You're smart. You're going to make progress in this situation. Let's be positive. Just drop the Hare Krishna point of view, the Srimad Bhagavatam point of view, and open your eyes. What do you see? On one of those branches is a honeycomb. And from the honeycomb is dripping some honey down the branch. You know exactly what to do. You're going to make progress. You start licking the honey because it's so near your face you can just stick out your tongue. Yes. You've made progress. You've become happy. What do you think? Isn't the main thing to get the honey? Be positive, be upbeat, come on. Don't be negative. Be open. What do you think? That taste of the honey just totally absorbs you and you forget all about your danger. In fact, you don't even care anymore about the danger. You just, the snakes are hissing below, the tiger is growling above, the rats are gnawing on the branches, but That is material existence. This is an example of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur gives to help us. Each element in this allegory represents something. The tiger who pursued you, you couldn't see the tiger, but you heard the growl, and you heard the sounds of the tiger coming through the jungle after you. That's death. And then you seek a solution to your material situation, to your material problems. You want progress. Ah, look at this, abandoned well. You hold on to the branches and lower yourself into the well. And what's at the bottom of the well? The snakes. Each snake represents another material problem. You've got death pursuing you. And while you're being pursued by death, you've got to cope with so many problems. So at the bottom of the well, the snakes are hissing. Our attitude in life is that if I just solve this problem, I'll be fine. And you even endow yourself with a kind of heroism. I've solved this problem. Just see my skill. Just see my ability. I've solved this problem. But there's so many snakes at the bottom of the well. How are you going to deal with them all? And the snakes, they're having children. So mother and father snake, which are problems, give birth to children snakes, which are problems. And those children snakes, they'll get together and they'll have their own snake, baby snakes. So the problems are just multiplying while you're hanging from those two branches. Of course, you're tasting the honey, remember. That is the main thing. The taste of honey. And what are those two branches you're holding on to? One branch represents pious activities, good karma. The other branch represents impious activities, bad karma. Now, at this point in Kali Yuga, who knows anything about pious activities? How many of you ever thought before getting knowledge of Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam that you needed to do some pious activities? This thing, your reaction if someone had mentioned that to you. Have you performed any pious activities? It's weird. What kind of strange word is that? A pious activity? All right. If we say good karma, that may sound more trendy these days. Have you done any good karma lately? Yeah, you know, I hope I helped an old lady walk across the street. There was some girl who was lonely and I helped her. Good karma, you know. Someone was too drunk at the party and couldn't find their way home and I drove the person home. Good karma. No, we don't know anything about good karma these days. It's not just something you imagine in your mind. It is something prescribed. It is specified, but no one knows about those things. So basically, you're just holding on to one branch these days with both hands, bad karma. And you can't even hold on to that because what's going on? The two rats are nibbling on the branch. The white rat, the black rat. The white rat represents daytime. The black rat represents nighttime. They're nibbling away. Time, in other words, won't let you just hang there, wondering what to do. Time is always moving on, just like the rats are always nibbling on the branch. You can't just tread water. Things are happening. But that honey is trickling from the honeycomb on the branch. Oh, how sweet it is. worthwhile. I'll get the relief that I want. I'll get the fulfillment I want. It'll make everything cozy in life. Such intimacy will help in bonding. It will help in reciprocation. That's what modern society does. Why modern society, any materialistic society, past, present, or future, just loads up all the emphasis on honey tasting. This is it. This is what you need. This will just set off a nuclear chain reaction of Ananda. Let's see how everyone is focused in that way. So this is all there is to material life. Tiger of death chasing you. You look for a solution, a way to push your life forward. You enter the abandoned well. The snakes are at the bottom, representing all the various problems of material life. You grab on to the one branch these days, just bad karma. You don't know anything about how to do good karma. And the two rats are nibbling on the branch. Your situation from any intelligent point of view is just hopeless. Bah. Trickling down the branch near your face. It's the honey. That makes it all worthwhile. So, this is Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's example. I didn't make it up. Queen Kunti, the most liberated woman and the truly liberated woman, is pointing out that if you're on this path, like the person in this example we spoke about, this path of material progress, trying to improve yourself with material opulence, you'll never be able to approach Krishna with sincere feeling. Now you might say, well, so what? Why all the emphasis on approaching Krishna with sincere feeling? Our impersonal tendencies will cause us to respond like that, consciously or unconsciously. We don't want to accept the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Because that means you're bound. It means you have to reciprocate in a personal relationship. We don't want that. We don't want to feel obligation. We don't want to feel that we need to be sensitive. Isn't that what you do when you don't want to deal with someone? You just treat them impersonally. You don't want to feel the inconveniences of acknowledging someone's personality. You don't want that impinging on your life. You want to do your thing. And in order to do your thing in this world, you have to desensitize most of the world's population, depersonalize them. That way you can easily just push forward with your life without thinking you're hurting so many people. And of course, you pat yourself on the back. That I have some friends, I have a partner temporarily, and I really care about their needs. But the rest of the world, you just basically blank out. They're just numbers or faces with no individuality, and that way you can push on with your program. It's like what anthropologists have found out when tribals fight each other. Often, they find out that the tribals who paint their faces are much more barbaric in battle than the ones who don't paint the faces. Because by painting the faces, they feel anonymous. And so they can just be extremely brutal and cruel. Whereas the tribals who don't paint their faces and engage in battle, they're more humane because they know I'm recognized. And tests have been done not simply on tribals, but on so-called civilized persons. And it's found out that if you just assign human beings numbers, then easily human beings will mistreat one another. In other words, you depersonalize that other person. Because as long as you think you're dealing with a person, it's hard for you to be barbaric. But just give the person a number. And refer to those persons as numbers. You're number 101, you're number 12. It's, immediately, you can make that adjustment. You can treat the person like they're just matter, as the scientists are telling you, and just disregard any sensitivities. Or another way is to not see the person that you're being cruel to. I've explained before, this was a test done at Yale University, a very famous experiment in which students were recruited and they had a switch that would give an electric shock and they could turn up the shock. And someone was there behind the screen and they couldn't see the person. So the psychologist who was running the test, very famous test, told the student, you don't have to worry. I take full responsibility for whatever happens. You don't know the person behind the screen. I take full responsibility for whatever happens. Just turn up the dial as you like. Increase the shock as you like. So in the vast majority of cases, the student would keep turning up the shock, the electric shock, and even the person behind the screen, who was actually an actor, is screaming, ah, 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 ah. But the student doesn't care, just, I don't see anyone behind the screen, and this one, the supervisor takes full responsibility, so what the heck? And the person behind the screen is just, ah. Finally, the student keeps turning up the volume of the shock, and the student behind the screen collapses on the floor. And the supervisor tells the student, he's unconscious, he's unconscious. But the student doesn't care. I don't see anyone, and you take full responsibility. So the vast majority of cases of the students who were recruited for this experiment, they, as soon as they knew, I can't see who's behind the screen, I don't know that person, and the supervisor here takes full responsibility, I'm going for it. The vast majority of cases. What do you say about that? And this, at the university that the Hindustan Times in India claims is the number two university in the world, behind Cambridge, for undergraduate students, and this is what's going on. Now, can you understand why you don't want Krishna to exist? You want Krishna behind the screen. You don't want him interfering with your life. And what's very repulsive to our material consciousness? That Krishna's in our heart. He knows everything and he sees everything. Isn't that an intimidating thought? Why can't we have a place in our heart that's private? Why can't there be a place in our heart where Krishna can't see? I mean, we should have our own private individuality. Isn't it a right in first world countries to have privacy? Good luck these days. Everything is monitored. Computers aren't simply to make your life more convenient as individuals. Computers are for better controlling the world. So, the thought can repulse you unconsciously. Oh, Krishna's in my heart. Why does he just mind his own business? Doesn't he have some leelas to do? Doesn't he have enough pastimes? You know, Dwarka, Vrindavan, Mathura. Isn't that enough to keep Krishna occupied? Why does he have to be so concerned what's in my heart? That's my business, my affair. We want to depersonalize Krishna. All right, what's the best way to do this and still be, and we'll still be spiritual? We depersonalize Krishna and refer to him as the impersonal Brahman. Yes, that does it, the all-pervading, yes. And we are that Brahman, we are it. We are the all-pervading absolute truth. There's no supreme, we are all Brahman. We are all the supreme reality. Isn't that a relief? Okay, that sounds very attractive. That sounds really spiritual. That everything is truth, and we all are the truth. We are it, and it is us. Don't you feel a sense of relief? There's no supreme. Thank you. I feel relieved from this primitive spirituality, which posits that there's a supreme, and we are subordinate. So, last century. Oh, this is what's going on. In India, in the West, in the East, in the North, in the South, you don't want to deal with Krishna, but you still want to be spiritual. As soon as you accept Krishna's personhood, that means relationships, sensitivities, obligations. It's like a father who acknowledges he has children, which is not done all the time these days. So often fathers like to sow their wild seeds and then, oh, you're pregnant? Oh. One out of me. That's your affair. Goodbye. The government will take care of you. That's why we pay GST, you know. One person actually explained to me like that. Said, you know, in my affairs, you know, I don't worry about the outcome. I don't take any precautions. I don't worry about the outcomes. Why? That's why I pay GST rates. It's the government's problem, you know? We pay them enough. If they happen to be children, you know, that's the government's business. Let the government raise them, you know? I pay enough money to the government. What do you think the government's for? Yeah, someone actually told me that. So, how to depersonalize Krishna? That is our unconscious goal. And here, Queen Kunti is talking about approaching the Lord with feeling. Oh, that when you want to approach someone with a feeling, it means you're sensitive. You're acknowledging their qualities, their activities. No, we don't want to do that. So this is our problem. In the purport, Srila Prabhupada is pointing out that a helpless man can feelingly utter the holy name of the Lord, whereas a man who utters the same holy name in great material satisfaction cannot be so sincere. All right, let's talk about this. Why should material satisfaction be bad? Why do we have to attack material satisfaction? What do you think? It's not that bad. Material satisfaction, I mean, what's wrong with it? Why do we have to be so down on it? Why can't we be broad and open-minded? One person also told me, like, the Vedas are broad. So what's wrong with there being material satisfaction? It's all Vedic. Now, it's true that the Vedas do contain the best prescriptions for material satisfaction, but they're always rejected. the best means for material satisfaction means you worship the demigods, you do good karma. It's all laid out in the Vedas. But it's rejected. This is for the fools. As Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, kamais taistaya hitagena prapadyantaya devata. Those who are unintelligent, their brains are distorted by lust, they take to these material processes for material elevation. So let's talk about material satisfaction. Let's get it out into the open. Why do we read here that it gets in the way? Well, I think it actually, our Chandidas was reminding me of a statement Prabhupada wrote in Bhagavad Gita. I think it was a few weeks ago. We were having a reading in the evening, and in decrying the process of material sense gratification, Srila Prabhupada said that it can appear that there is some small satisfaction or pleasure for material gratification. So he conceded, it can appear that way. We like to really jump on that one. Okay, that's the opening we need. It can appear to me. It can seem. Ooh, the honey trickling down the ridge. So, yes, that is the nature of material existence. It can appear to be. There's such a thing as material satisfaction. And we're so desperate, we're so crazy. Just that appearance is enough for us to base our whole life on it. It can appear that there's some material satisfaction. But, he explained, that appearance is the greatest enemy of the conditioned soul. Because you get so hung up in that appearance that you become mad. And you won't accept that it's just an appearance. That's all. What is the Kali Yuga mantra? An appearance is good enough for me. It was good enough for Mama. It was good enough for Papa. It's good enough for me. And if you happen to have any children that you recognize, you'll pass that same tradition down to them. We become mad just by the appearance. That it could appear to be material satisfaction. It could appear to actually exist. We become mad. And you spoil your spiritual life. You spoil even your chances of approaching spiritual life because you feel confident. I've got it. I've got it. I'm having it. Into it. So when you look at teenagers, that's the madness that's afflicting them. But the adults, they say, oh, the teenagers, they'll grow out of it. But have the adults gotten over it? Have they grown out of it? No way. Simply, adult life means, what does it mean these days? You package the degradation more, more cleverly, that's all. The same things are going on, but you just package it in a more socially acceptable way. Whereas when you're a teenager, you just don't care. Whatever. Oh, now I'm an adult. Oh, I've grown up. Okay. You do things in a more clandestine or more secretive way, more sophisticated way. That's the only difference. So please just think about it. The possibility that material satisfaction exists is the greatest enemy of the conditioned soul because you go mad over that vague possibility of the appearance of it. It's so insubstantial. What does Prahlad Maharaj say? 5-year-old boy giving his realization? Sukham hi tuccham. He says, all right. There's some sukha, there's some material happiness there. But it's so tiny. What's the use in talking about it? Sukha iducha, it means certainly so insignificant, there's no point in even talking about it. Tell that to anyone today. What do you mean, no point in talking about it? That is the thing to talk about. The whole world is based on that. And Prahlad is saying, Sukha Nidujam? These are the kind of books you're reading? So Prahlad, just like Prabhupada in the Gita, he conceives. Okay, there's a little something there. But we, oh, yes, it's there. You see, Prahlad agrees, it's there. Sukha Nidujam. It's so insignificant, it's not even worth talking about. It's like on this floor or on the ceiling. Just looking up now, I see that. Is that a hole on the ceiling right there?
Yes.
Yes. Now, perhaps on the whole ceiling, it looks like that's the only little hole. Everyone see that hole right there?
Yeah.
But how does the size of that hole compare with the size of the ceiling? Now, would you say the whole ceiling, the entire ceiling is this hole? No, there's a little hole there. Would you make a big thing about it? Oh, the whole building is ruined. Bhumna Krishna, what have you done? Krishna Prasad, what have you done? Who jumped up during kirtan and touched a hole in their finger? The whole building needs to be demolished. No, he wouldn't say that. He'd just say, oh, well, it's insignificant. So, similarly, Prahlad Maharaj says, Sukha Vidujam. Insignificant. But it makes us mad, and we can't call out to Krishna with feeling. And that is real progress. This is what Kunti Devi wants to inform us of. The quality in calling out to Krishna, that's what attracts Krishna. Bhakti Yoga means continually making progress in increasing our feeling that we call out to Krishna. And that means dependency. I've said it again, if you want to understand dependency in relationship with Krishna, just watch small children. You don't have to have your own to do that. Just watch others, it's cheaper. I was watching Dayavir's daughter the other day, and she feels so blissful, just bright blue eyes and a happy look on her face, just knowing I'm dependent. I have wonderful parents. Everything is fine. What is she doing for herself? She's not providing for herself. She's not protecting herself. But she's got this happy look on her face. Everything is wonderful. I get whatever I need. Now, what would you say? You come along, you fool, you're dependent on your parents. Is that what you say? You foolish kid, rebel, stand up for yourself, you have rights, do your own thing. Would anyone here say that? Of course not. You appreciate all, you should be dependent. You have such nice parents. Growing up in a Krishna conscious atmosphere, caring mother, caring father, you depend. You wouldn't criticize. So then why is it we have a problem with depending on Krishna? We have to fend for ourselves because we just don't know what Krishna is going to do. And who is Krishna anyway? If you acknowledge Krishna too much, it gets too personal. Things get too sticky with Krishna. Right? Better you worship Krishna officially, like some religious traditions. Sing official hymns, and keep any supreme being at a distance. Okay, look, we throw some hymns at you. Be cool now. This is not bhakti. Bhakti means coming closer and closer with more and more feeling.
That's what Koji Devi wants. That's what she's talking about, is real human progress. How do we arrange our life so that we're always calling out to Krishna with feeling? That takes lifestyle management. Now just think, the goal of your life is not to increase your material security. You can't do that more than your karma anyway. The goal of your life is not to increase your material satisfaction, because it's practically non-existent. There's just a hallucination that it exists, not hallucination. As Chandidas reminded me, is the greatest enemy of the conditioned world. So, real progress for bhakti yogis is how to increase the feeling and calling out to Krishna. Let's break out of our impersonal shackles and recognize them. So Kunti Devi is saying, the more materially impoverished you are, it's easier to call out to Krishna with sincere feeling. Now, does that mean everyone has to, whatever, you know, items you have to throw them all out? Quit your jobs, burn down your house, and then I'm materially impoverished. Dhamma kinchana gocha. I can approach Krishna with feeling. No. We're following Rupa Goswami's dictum that yukta vairagya, use everything that's temporarily in your possession. Use it all for Krishna's pleasure. If you can't use it for Krishna's pleasure, don't have it. That's why an essential part of the Brahmana's lifestyle is giving and receiving charity. So he'd say, well, what does a Brahmana have to give? Well, people are always giving charity to the Brahmana, and the Brahmana only accepts what is needed. So therefore, there's a lot of giving in return, giving away. So if we keep this principle in mind, and we're always analyzing, do I need this for Krishna's service? What will this thing have as value in Krishna's service? And that's our sincere intention. Krishna will give us more and more ability how to distinguish and discriminate in that way. You may not get it perfect immediately, but you're on the path. You're like a child growing in the right way. I want to become more and more expert at using things in Krishna's service or not using them at all. That is the bhakti approach to the world. How to use everything in Krishna's service. Whether you're rich or poor, you're super rich if you have that attitude, no matter what your external circumstances are. Therefore, Bhagavatam will present some devotees who are unlimitedly wealthy, like Yudhisthira or Ambarish Maharaj, and it'll also present some devotees who are totally impoverished, like Sudama Brahmana. But as we pointed out, Sudama Brahmana, he got attached to being impoverished, and Krishna didn't like that. Krishna doesn't like you to be attached to any duality. Oh, you're very attached to being a super renounced Brahmana. You're very attached to being impoverished and having nothing. Well, I'll give you more wealth than Indra. Krishna knows exactly how to deal with each devotee. And we can't resent that. I know some of you look around at other devotees. Why does this one have money and I don't? Why does she have such a nice husband and I don't? Why does he have such a house and our family doesn't? And you may get spun out in that way. Your head may spin in that way. But if you learn to look for the quality of engaging everything in Krishna's service, then you'll see the real wealth. then you'll see real prosperity, real progress. Because everyone has their individual circumstances that you're bringing with your body to your bhakti practice. Those circumstances are external, of course, but nevertheless, you're bringing them. They're not the main thing at all, but still, you're bringing them. Everyone's bodies here have different degrees of sickness and health. That means everyone's body also has different money karma, as is loosely called. So you can't become confused by that. Just like, you know, some devotees, they're bringing a sick body. Similarly, some devotees are bringing a money body. And it's all the same. Some have sickly bodies and they have money. Others have healthy bodies, they don't have any money. Some have sickly bodies and no money, and they have a nice wife. Others have a healthy body and lots of money, and well. I think it nagged a lot. Some live in a small house in beautiful sunny Otaki, and others live in a beautiful apartment, in the middle of a smog-infested city. So how do you judge, Queen Kunti said, don't bother judging this external stuff. Look to see, for real progress, who is calling out to Krishna with feeling. So this is not religious sentiment. Why would you think that way? Even in material existence, people tell each other, you've got to do what you do with feeling. When you go to try to get a corporate job, in the interview, they want to ascertain, do you have the feeling for this job? There's so many persons who have the skills, but will you show feeling? So you've got to convince the interviewer that I'm going to feel for this company. They even say, "What?" In the job interviews, they ask you, what are your passions? Because they want to see, do you have a passion for life that will transfer to this corporation? What are your passions? What do you pour your heart into? Look, we've got 200 applicants. We want to find the one who's going to give us the most bhakti. Right? Yo, today you're still working for the bank? Yeah, they're slave masters, right? And they want to, he was telling me all about life at the bank in Canberra. How they want to try to motivate you to sacrifice more by offering you the possibility, the appearance of a promotion in the future. You could rise above being just a, what do you call them, cashiers? The tellers? Huh? Tellers. So you're starting as a teller now, but if you just work hard, grueling hard, you could rise above to become, what's the next position?
Sales advisor.
Sales advisor. You get to sit at one of those desks when people come in. And then what's beyond that?
Sales and service advisor.
Sales and service advisor. And then?
Manager.
Branch manager. Oh. And by that time, you're how old?
34
years old. So they want to see, do you have feeling? Are you just taking this as a routine job? And he was telling me they're always having meetings with the tellers to explain to them that this is just not an ordinary thing you're doing. You've got to feel it. We want bank tellers who feel it. So what is so unusual about Kunti Devi saying, give feeling to Krishna? Oh, well, Krishna. Oh, I can't even leave this alone. Doesn't he have enough already?
So, let's talk about one of Krishna's leelas, Shyaman Takajula. Apparently, Krishna is caught in defamation. And it's all about an object, a precious object that is supposed to bestow the highest fortune everywhere. Instead, because someone's materially attached to it, it brings about the greatest misfortune. So there's this personality who lived in the general district of Dwarka. He wasn't an inside resident of Dwarka, but in the general vicinity. And he was a devotee of the sun god. And so, because he so faithfully served this demigod, he was awarded by the sun god with this Shyamantaka jewel. More brilliant in its effulgence than anything people would ordinarily see in the material world. And not only that, but this Shyamantaka jewel, when offered puja, would produce huge amounts of gold every day. Well, this sounds like this Sachadra, he was really set up, right? So, he arrived inside Dwarka, Sachadra, wearing the jewel around his neck, and his effulgence was so dazzling that people thought, this is the sun god. The sun god has come. And then they thought, well, that's natural because all the topmost devas come to see Krishna. Krishna is here in Dwarka, pretending to be an ordinary mortal. But the devas who understand, they know that even though Krishna is hidden amongst the yadus in that way, he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So why shouldn't Viraswan, Surya come and see Krishna? Look, that must be the sun god. Look at that effulgence, unparalleled. Can we have some more air in here, please? So, they went to tell Krishna. Krishna, Surya has come to see you. It's natural all the demigods want to see you. And we're so fortunate to be here in Dwarka with you, Krishna. And in approaching Krishna, how do they get his attention? By chanting Krishna's names. Oh, Narayan. Oh, supreme shelter of everything. Oh, Damodar Vindaksha, oh, lotus-eyed Damodar, son of Yashoda, you have that past we know in Braj, and your mother bound you in ropes when you were a child. So we're also referring to you as Damodar Vindaksha, lotus-eyed Damodar. Govinda, we know you give pleasure to the cows and the senses. Jagatpati, your lord of the universe. And, of course, you're also Yadu Nandana. You're our own son of the Yadu dynasty. Jai Sri Krishna, you're with us. They caught Krishna's attention that way by chanting his names. And they presented what they thought was a reality. The sun god is coming to see you. It's obvious why he would want to do that. But Krishna just smiled. He reciprocated with them by smiling and told them, actually, it's not so. It's not Surya, it is Sachadri wearing the Shyamantaka jewel. So, now, see what's going on behind the scenes. Sachadri knew that Krishna knew he was in the city of Dwarka with the jewel, but he didn't come to see Krishna. Why? Because he was already attached to having this jewel. The seeds of attachment were growing rapidly already. So he didn't come and pay his obeisances to Krishna. He was so caught up in worshiping the jewel at his home, offering it puja, just like those of you who have shaligram shilas and deities at home. So Sachadri was offering daily puja and getting the daily mounds of gold. He didn't even consider voluntarily coming to see Krishna. That's what happens when we get a good material thing that we become attached to. Our spiritual life reduces because of that attachment. We have to see, do I really know how to use everything in Krishna's service? Is this thing really, can it really be used in Krishna's service? Or is it just my own thing? Am I just in the guise of serving Krishna? Am I using this thing for myself? But Satyajit didn't go through that process. He just enjoyed. So, eventually, Krishna summoned him, saying, you know, Ugrasen is the king here. Everything of the finest order should be presented to the king. That's the tradition, you know, that's the proper principle for all the citizens. Please bring the Shyamantaka jewel and give it to King Ugrasen, like every loyal subject should do. This is Vedic civilization. There's no GST. You know? You give the best of everything to the king, and the king arranges that you live peacefully. Isn't that what everyone wants? They want security. And the Vedic conception of security imparted by a government is no diseases, no famines, no crime, no physical or mental disturbances of any type. The government head is supposed to do all that. Now try to vote for someone today who will do that. So that's why Krishna said, bring the jewel to the king. The king is providing all these benefits. People don't even have mental or physical disturbances. There are no famines, there's no climate change, there's no erratic weather, there's prosperity. It's all because of the king. That's the king's job. But Satyajit just dismissed what Krishna requested. He just acted like Krishna's request had no value. This was the beginning of downfall. That jewel had mystic potency, that wherever the jewel was situated, there would be no pestilence, there would be no natural disturbances, there would be no untimely death. The jewel could do all that. It was meant to grant auspiciousness everywhere. But now you're going to see, because of Satyajit's material attachments, what was meant to bring fortune is now going to bring misfortune. What was the first thing? The first string of misfortunes. Satyajit's brother, Prasena, decided he was going to profile with the jewel. To give prestige to his family, he was going to parade around with the jewel. So he wore the jewel around his neck, and he decided to go for a ride on his horse in the forest, just showing off. He got into the forest, and a lion saw the jewel, saw Satyajit and the horse, and the lion decided, I'm king of the forest, I want the jewel. So the lion killed Prasena, he killed the horse, and took the jewel. What's a lion going to do with such a jewel? But that's the whole nature of material existence. You actually don't even know what you're going to do with something when you get it. You think it's going to make you happy, and you are disappointed. Anyway, the lion took the jewel. Then entered Jambavan, the strongest warrior on the earth planet. He saw the lion with the jewel, and what's a lion doing with this jewel? With bare hands, he killed the lion, took the jewel, and went back to his house, which was at the end of a deep tunnel through the earth. And because Jambavan is a devotee of Lord Ramchandra, he said, what are we bhakti yogis need with such a jewel? It's a toy. I give it to my little son, my little babe. He gave this most valuable gem to his little child to play with, like a toy truck or something. Remember, this jewel produces mounds of gold every day. But Jambavan, he's a bhakti yogi.
this precious jewel for? Gold. Just give it to my kid. So, Persena obviously doesn't come back from the forest. And what does Satyadri start thinking? Krishna wanted that jewel. He did something to my brother, and he took the jewel. So Satyadri started spreading that rumor throughout Dwarka. And somewhere other in the vicinity of Dwarka were also evil-minded persons, similar, and they listened to that rumor and started spreading it even more. This rumor was going everywhere, like wildfire, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says. You have experience how rumors can start and just get way out of shape and out of proportion. Krishna did that. You don't say. Krishna killed Prasena and took the jewel. Did you hear that? This happens even to Krishna. What does it mean to others? You saw on the internet what Krishna did. He did that to Prasena? Yeah, he wanted the jewel. That's where he's really at. Just wanted the jewel, even kill Prasena. What's the proof? Do you see Prasena anywhere? Do you see the jewel anywhere? Think about it. Krishna's motivated. He did that. Okay. And that person tells another person. Is that the door? Kitchen. Everything's all right. The gas bottle exploded or something. So, all these rumors were being spread everywhere, and Krishna decided to do something about it. Now, the question is, why would Krishna decide to do something about it? Shouldn't he just, you know, hey, let them talk? Well, there are different ways to respond to such rumors and blasphemy and ill talk. The Brahmana way to deal with it is, what do I care? It's got nothing to do with me. Let people talk. That's the way of material existence. That's the Brahmana's way of doing things. But Krishna in Dwarka is acting as a Kshatriya. And Kshatriyas are very concerned with reputation because their whole rule over the people is based on reputation. I can give protection. I can give good management. So when there is when bad talk is spread about a Kshatriya, he does something. Now, what do we do in amongst our bhakti society when rumors spread? We do a combination of both, because as individuals, we don't care. A real devotee's attitude is, people are saying bad about me. Well, they finally understood things rightly. They actually don't know how bad I am. That's actually the devotee's response. Yes, let them talk. They, you know, they see rightly. It's not that you immediately hire a defense attorney or something. They're talking about me. That's the classic devotee attitude. Just like in Chaitanya Leela, Srivas Thakur. You know, at his house, there were always these nighttime kirtans of such ecstasy. And Lord Chaitanya and his followers would always lock the door, and they wouldn't let outsiders in because they didn't want to see non-devotees observe their ecstatic symptoms because they wouldn't understand. And also, the mentality of the non-devotee would interfere with the bliss of the kirtan. The devotees couldn't fully express themselves. So they locked the door.
So some of the caste brahmanas in Navadvip became incensed by this. We want to come see. We want to come see the Haris jump up and down, break out in their so-called ecstasy. We want to come see it, like, you know, it's a spectacle. But they couldn't get in, the door was locked. So in their anger, they decided to smear Srivast Thakur. Okay, he's known as a big Vaishnav, a big devotee of Krishna. This is what we'll do. On his doorstep, we'll put all the articles for Durga Puja, worshiping Durga, on his doorstep. And so that way we'll smear his reputation that he's pretending to be a big monotheist, a big lover of Krishna, when actually he's just worshiping such a fierce demigoddess as Durga for material benefit. So they did that. Srivast Thakur woke up in the morning, because they did that at night, and he saw the articles on his front step. What did he do? He called the whole town. Come see where I'm really at. Come see, you know, what my nature really is. You see these articles on my doorstep? That's me. I show you, you know, what my consciousness really is. Of course, those who were devotees, they understood who has done this to Srivast Thakur. And those who were ill-minded, yes, 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 now he's smeared. So, in our Krishna conscious society, a real devotee is not affected, but for the sake of giving others a chance to be Krishna conscious, we take action. It's not that we're doing it for ourselves, but we do it for the sake of others. Krishna responded to the rumors because he's acting as a kshatriya who's responsible for maintaining law and order. Law and order depends on the good faith of the people, that they allow the government to function. So Krishna, because kshatriyas deal in wealth and fame and reputation, for the sake of his profile as a kshatriya, he took action because all these rumors were going on. What did he do? He, with some prominent citizens of Dwarka, he made sure he took prominent citizens as witnesses. They went into the forest to search for Prasena, Satyajit's brother, to just to clear Krishna's name. So, they went to the forest, they searched, and what did they find? They found the dead body of the horse, they found the dead body of Prasena, and they found the dead body of the lion, but no jewel. And they heard that from some forest dwellers that Jambavan had taken the jewel. Where does Jambavan live? It was pointed out. See that entrance to a dark tunnel. Frighteningly long and dark tunnel. His residence is way at the end of this long tunnel through the ground. So Krishna knew, these prominent citizens of Dwarka who've accompanied me, they're going to be very afraid to enter this dark tunnel into nowhere. Who knows where it ends up. Let them stay at the edge of the tunnel, the entrance to the tunnel. Let them stay there and wait for me. I'll go in myself. So Krishna alone entered the long dark tunnel. And he got to the end, and there was Jambavan's house. And Krishna saw first Jambavan's little boy playing with the jewel, the Shyamantaka jewel. And his nurse was there, his babysitter. And she saw Krishna, and she was afraid. Who is this? Now you may say, why was she afraid by seeing Krishna? Vishwanath Chakri Thakur gives a detail that externally it looked like she was afraid, but actually she was overwhelmed with ecstasy. It's Krishna. But the way the pastime goes, she apparently expressed fear, calling out, and immediately Jambavan came running.
Who's making a disturbance? And Jambavamba is so angry. What stranger is in my home bothering my boy and trying to take the jewel which I gave as a toy to my boy? It wasn't that he was so attached to the jewel, it's just that he gave it to his son, his little boy, the chip off the old block, my boy. Who's disturbing my boy? He was so angry that he didn't recognize this is Krishna, even though he's a devotee. Particularly he's a devotee of Ram, but still, he should recognize this is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So immediately, let's fight, because he's a warrior. So they fought for 28 days and nights straight without a break. First with weapons, then with tree trunks, then with stones, and then they just started smashing each other with their bare fists. 28 days straight, day and night, no break. So, now why did Jambavan do that? He was angry on one level. He didn't recognize this is Bhagavan. But on another level, it was all arranged by Krishna's yogamaya potency. Krishna wanted a good fight. So with his yogamaya energies, he covered over Jambavan so Jambavan wouldn't recognize, this is my Lord Ram, this is the original personality Godhead. Krishna didn't want him to see that. Krishna wanted him to fight. Why? Because Krishna's thinking, I had to fight with Chanura, Kamsa, Jarasandha, all these small-time demons, but they're no fun at all. I need a real battle. So I have to get that for my devotee. These small-time demons like Kamsa, those playthings, that was no real test. So Krishna covered over Jambavan. So Jambavan wouldn't recognize that he is the Supreme Personality of God, and Jambavan would fight him. And Krishna also knew, I want to satisfy my devotee. Jambavan's a warrior. He hasn't had a good fight. He hasn't been able to taste vira rasa, the rasa of heroism, chivalry. So I'll do him a favor and myself a favor too. We'll fight. So Jambavan battled single-handedly the forces of Ravana, and still he wasn't satisfied. So we'll both fight each other, and that way we'll satisfy each other. So they battled 28 days and nights straight. Finally, when they're pounding each other with fists, Jambavan is getting so exhausted. His huge bulging muscles are just flattening as Krishna is smashing him. And Jambavan's wondering, who can defeat me? Who is this that can actually defeat me and make me so exhausted? My muscles are flat. This has never happened before. And then he begins to understand, this can only be my worshipful Lord. This must be Ramchandra come as Krishna. So then he begins to offer prayers to the Lord. Now, from the bhakti point of view, why is it that Jambavan, of course, yes, he was covered by yogamaya, but from the way the pastime manifests, Jambavan finally recognized this is Bhagavan, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, because he had done service. He had offered Krishna the service of fighting. Therefore, after 28 days and nights, he started to realize he got the result of his devotional service. It's Krishna. So then he offered prayers to Krishna. So, we can go into those prayers, but maybe tomorrow we'll go into those prayers. After offering prayers to Krishna, Jambavan decided, I've got to give you something. Not simply the jewel, because Krishna explained it. Look, you know, this jewel thing is a bit of a problem. You know, people are defaming me. You know, they're interneting me. They're can you do me a favor? Give me the jewel, you know, so I can, you know, take it back to Dwarka and clear my name. So Jambavan says, take the jewel. Not only take the jewel, but I give you my beautiful virgin daughter, Jambavati.
Of course, you see, in Vedic culture, for a man to give his virgin daughter is considered like great opulence and wealth you're giving away. These days in Kali Yuga, it'd probably be considered like, you know, an affliction. Oh, is something wrong with her, huh? She hasn't been plundered? What's wrong with her? Psychotic? The liability. I've heard from our lady devotees how in secondary school, you know, packs of girls torture girls who, you know, with rumors and ridicule. Who do you think you are? Trying to keep yourself away from all that, huh? They make the girl feel so bad. You're weird. And who are behind, who's motivating the girls to do that? The boys, of course, make fun of her. Make her break down. So it's all just, you know, it's a mongrel pack. So, in Vedic culture, an untouched virgin girl is considered opulence. It's considered high wealth. As I said, though, today it's considered, this is considered like a defect, strange, weird. So, Jambavan gave Jambavati. And Krishna went back to Dwarka, not only with the jewel, but with Jambavati. Meanwhile, in Dwarka, what was going on? Remember the prominent citizens who Krishna had told, stay at the entrance to the tunnel, I'll be back? After 12 days, they just didn't know what was going on. So they decided, some ill has happened to Krishna, something ill. We have to go back to Dwarka and give the report. They got back to Dwarka and they informed everyone. Krishna disappeared into the tunnel. We waited for 12 days. Obviously, something's happened. He's disappeared, or we don't know what. Some calamity has happened. And so Devaki and Vasudev and Krishna's chief wife, Rukmini, they are all lamenting. And they started thinking, who could be the cause of this misfortune that Krishna may have disappeared? Satyajit. So they started counter rumors against him. Yeah, that's the only reason why Krishna didn't come back. Something bad has happened. It's got to be Satyajit spreading those rumors. So Rukmini and Vasudev and Devaki and the Yadu started spreading counter rumors. And they were so worried, they even went to the temple of Durga to ask for a benediction that Krishna would return. You see, in Krishna Lila, you can actually approach demigods for the purpose of serving Krishna. The gopis did it. They prayed to an expansion of Durga to have Krishna as their husband. So the residents of Dwarka, they're going to Durga to beg for Krishna's return. And so they got a favorable response from the Durga deity in the temple. And immediately, Krishna shows up and everyone is overjoyed. Not only has Krishna come back, and not only has he brought the jewel, but he's got another beautiful wife. So, Krishna tells King Ugrasen, call a whole meeting of the government so I can explain what really happened, so I can clear my name. So Ugrasena does that. And in front of a government assembly, Krishna explains how Prasena was killed by the lion, and then the lion was killed by Jambavan, and Jambavan had the jewel, and Krishna and Jambavan fought. And now Krishna, he said, I've come back with the jewel and with Jambavati. So everyone's very happy. And then Krishna calls Satyajit, and he comes hanging his head down low. And Satyajit, he thinks, what am I going to do? How am I going to solve this situation? Krishna's calling me. I caused such a commotion. D defaming Krishna. We'll talk more tomorrow. Actually, Satyaji had a problem with Krishna. He didn't really like him. So why then is Satyajit about to give the jewel to Krishna? And he thinks, not only will I give the jewel, but I've got to do something that will keep people from treating me inimically. I mean, I could have the whole Yadu dynasty on my back. They might try to rub me out. They're old warriors. I did something horrible, I know it. I offended Krishna. I spread blasphemy about him, I offended him. And this is Dwarka, you know, I gotta be practical. I'm in Krishna's city, and I've offended him. The Yadus could be breathing down my back any moment. I've gotta come up with something to save my own skin. I know what, not only will I give the jewel to Krishna, but I'll also give my beautiful daughter, Satyabhama. Now, Satyadri had promised his daughter Satyabhama to everyone. He was that kind of guy, you know, he just wanted everyone to appreciate him. So his daughter was so exquisite. Any Kshatriya who crossed Satyadri's path practically said, oh, you can marry my daughter in the future. It's a way of like peddling influence, you know? She'll be for you. She'll be for you. He had promised her to so many, but then he gave her to Krishna. Of course, Satyabhama is Krishna's energy, eternal consort. But these are Leelas. So, Satyadri gives Krishna the jewel and gives him his daughter, Satyabhama. And Krishna gives him back the jewel. Why? Because Krishna can see he's attached to it. He really doesn't want to give it with bhakti. He's doing it as an artifice, as a, you know, a diplomatic move to save his own skin. He's so attached to it. So Krishna said, oh no, you take it back. You're a devotee of the sun god. It's kind of sarcastic the way Krishna said, you're a devotee of the sun god. Take the jewel back. Go on worshiping the sun god. Don't bother us. And besides, what do I need a jewel for? I've already got the most precious thing. I've got Satyabhama. I think Krishna knows how to enjoy. So, out of all this, Krishna gets two beautiful wives. Jambavati and Satyabhama. How can you compete with that? All while apparently clearing his name. Which was just actually nothing for Krishna. The main thing was getting Jambavati and Satyabhama. So how are you going to compete with that? But things go on. The plot hasn't stopped. And we'll speak more about that tomorrow. And thank you for your kind attention. Hare Krishna.